scientists, evolution has to go operate under the second law of thermodynamics. And it was Francisco Ayala, a theistic evolutionist at the University of California, Irvine, who determined many years ago, and actually he was speaking at a conference on the search for the extraterrestrial intelligent life. And he said, just based on the probabilities of starting with microbes, what's the probability of getting intelligent beings? And he basically calculated that probability was less than one chance in 10 to the 1 millionth power. And so his whole point is, I don't think we're gonna find extraterrestrial intelligent life because the probability is quite tiny. Now, what he did not do is apply that probability to us. I mean, there's only one chance in 10 to the 1 millionth power that we would come about as a result of this process. And there was three physicists, John Barrow, Frank Tipler, and Carter, I'm trying to think of his first name, actually made the point that there are certain significant steps that must be met in addition to just having to work through gene exchange and mutations and natural selection, and that you need to take into account the physical conditions of the universe and the Earth. And they said that Francisco Ayala's probability calculation was way too optimistic, that the probability is actually less than one chance in 10 to the 24 millionth power that, beginning with microbes, you'd wind up with the equivalent of human beings. And to put that probability in some kind of context, that's roughly equivalent to you winning the California lottery 3 million consecutive times, where you buy one ticket each time. Or, as a mathematician friend of mine said, it's no different than the probability of winning the California lottery 3 million consecutive times where you don't buy any tickets at all. It's the same probability. So just based on working through these models, just simply presuming that the laws of physics have always operated like they do today, and as an astronomer, I can tell you we got measurements that prove that indeed the laws of physics have not changed over the course of the 14 billion year history of the universe. Incidentally, that's something that the Bible claimed thousands of years ago, that God designed the universe where the laws of physics don't change. That on that basis, I think we would be quite skeptical of the idea that we human beings are the product of some naturalistic evolutionary process. But another simple critique, and I'm giving you the simple stuff first, then we'll get into the little more complicated material. But how does one get conscious spiritual beings from non-conscious matter? I mean, so you're starting off with physics and chemistry, and physics and chemistry doesn't have any consciousness. So how do you explain non-conscious material producing consciousness? And the principle here is that effects cannot be greater than their causes, or the created cannot be greater than the creator. And so how can you get consciousness from something that's not conscious? Or to put it another way, the living, the personal, the mindful, the conscious, and the spiritual cannot come from that which is non-living, impersonal, unconscious, mindless, and non-spiritual. And just to pick up where we left off last week on the origin of life, I mean, I was talking last week about the bottom-up approach to the origin of life, trying to put chemicals together and see if we can get something more complicated, and making the point that you need someone who's very intelligent, highly funded, with great technology, even to make the simple steps. But another thing that biochemists have been doing is taking a living organism, a simple microbe, and taking away a few of the proteins, or one of the critical proteins that causes it to die. And so you take something that's all put together, you remove a key component, put the key component back in and see if you can bring it back to life. They can't. And so that's what's called the top-down approach. Pull a piece out so it's no longer functioning like it should. It's kind of like an automobile. You take a key component out, it's not going to run. You put the key component back in, and it does run. But you still got to put the key in the ignition. And so one of the things we're discovering is it seems like there's some kind of key that you got to put in the ignition to bring it back. But this is an even more complex point. Here we got human beings that are conscious and spiritual, personal, mindful, and living. How do you get that from something that lacks all those features? Now, from a Christian perspective, we can understand that the Creator has all these functions, has all these attributes. Therefore, he's in a position to create that which has all these properties. Well, that's the simple stuff. Let me begin by defining terms, because this is what draws a lot of confusion in the origin of humanity debate. Did we come from a caveman or Cro-Magnon? Who are the hominids? And what about Homo sapiens? Well, I'd be cautious about using the term caveman, because there are humans that live in caves. Matter of fact, I think there's some rather sophisticated gentlemen in America today that build special caves in their homes, and they're loaded up with certain equipment. So you might be justified in referring to someone who's really quite technologically endowed as a caveman. And the word Cro-Magnon has disappeared from the scientific literature for the simple reason we recognize the Cro-Magnons are fully modern in their humanity. So we're all Cro-Magnons. There's no difference between a Cro-Magnon and a Homo sapiens sapiens. Now, the term hominids refers to any mammal that has, say, a body size bigger than 3 feet tall that is capable of bipedal capability. And so another term would be a bipedal primate. But for example, if you've got a chimpanzee who's got a broken arm, that chimpanzee becomes bipedal. The chimpanzee prefers not to walk on two legs, but can walk on two legs. And there are bears that can walk on two legs. But however, the hominids are referring to creatures that have some facility on walking on two legs, some better than others. And the term Homo sapiens does not refer to us. We're a subcategory of the Homo sapiens. So the Homo sapiens actually refers to several different bipedal primate species. And say, well, what do they call modern humans? We're referred to as Homo sapiens sapiens. That's human beings. So again, don't use the term Homo sapiens for modern humans. We're Homo sapiens sapiens. In other words, we think twice. Okay. Now, the research findings concerning these bipedal primates is that in every case, the non-human bipedal primate populations are small and local. Now, if the populations are small and local, that immediately limits the possibility of them being able to evolve in any significant way. The probability of getting evolutionary change is proportional to the population size and also the habitat size. So in both cases, that's quite limited. They were using tools, but what we notice is the tool use is simple. In other words, we're talking single rocks or a piece of wood. It's not like what we humans do where we join a piece of wood to a rock with some sinews to make it a rather sophisticated tool. The tools in all cases of non-human bipedal primates are simple, and for what it's worth, chimpanzees also use simple tools. And so they'll use rocks, for example, to crack open nuts that can't be cracked open in any other way. In all cases, the bipedal primate's tool use is not as sophisticated as what we see from ravens and crows. So ravens and crows have a more sophisticated tool use than we see there. In terms of the time span, the earliest existed 6.5 million years ago. The most recent went extinct about 33,000 years ago. And in every single case, we're not able to observe technological advance in their tool use. To give you an example, Neanderthals have been around here on planet Earth for about 120,000 years. But we see no advance in their tool technology over that 120,000 years. They've been here a lot longer than we humans have, and yet we don't see any advance in their technology. Now, something else we observe about these bipedal primates is that the fossil record is not a tree. Rather, it looks like a hedge. And what I mean by that, instead of seeing some progressive development in the morphology and the genetics, we see that it bounces around. So the prediction was that if we indeed have evolved from a common ancestor with the chimpanzees and the Neanderthals, we're going to see a progressive building up of the brain size and a progressive building up of bipedal capability. But instead, what we see in about the dozen different bipedal primate fossils or species that have been discovered so far is that you'll see the brain size go up, then it drops down, it goes up and drops down. Also, the bipedal capability will, instead of going smoothly up, it jumps up and down. It is such that what you see in the scientific literature is with the discovery of every new bipedal primate species, it throws the evolutionary model into greater chaos rather than less chaos. So the hope was, as we discover these, it would fit the tree model. And actually what we're discovering is, in each case, it's showing that the tree model is incorrect. New finds add chaos to the naturalistic models. Now, in terms of who is Homo sapiens, we're not referring to human species. There's a species called Homo sapiens idaltu. And very roughly, it's a tropical Neanderthal type. It's a creature similar to the Neanderthal, but with a morphology designed to live in a warm climate rather than a cold climate. Lived about 80,000 to 250,000 years ago, shows no evidence for symbolic capability. Incidentally, that's true of all the non-human bipedal primates. We see no evidence for symbolic capability, no evidence for worship, and no technological advance. Now, the one that's probably gotten the most attention and where we have the greatest amount of data are the Neanderthals. We actually today have more than 20 complete skeletons of Neanderthals. Mitochondrial DNA has been recovered from more than 20 different specimens. But what we notice is we can't measure any evolution in the DNA. In other words, the oldest DNA doesn't look any different from the more recent DNA. And if evolution is going on, we would expect to find that there's some progression, some change in a particular direction of the DNA, and we're not seeing that. The DNA is distinct relative to human DNA. Now, to be clear, Neanderthal DNA, the part that we can measure. We can only measure about two-thirds of the genome of the Neanderthal. And incidentally, it's the only one where we got DNA. DNA corrupts over time, but Neanderthals are sufficiently recent that the corruption is not so severe. But as it is, we've only got about two-thirds of genome. But if we compare that two-thirds with the relative two-thirds in the human genome, it's about 99% the same. Now, before we get too disturbed by that, your DNA is also 26% identical to daffodil DNA. There's a reason why the creator likes to repeat DNA designs. And actually, that's very helpful for medical advance, the fact that our DNA is similar to the DNA of many other animals. I think I mentioned last week that mice and rats have a DNA that's remarkably similar to human DNA in terms of brain chemistry, and also in terms of the digestive tract. And so we're able to use mice and rats to develop medical technological advance for our human digestive system and also for the way our brains function. And that's what's interesting, because their DNA is a lot more similar to ours in that area than is the case of the great apes. We see no symbolic capability for the Neanderthals. They were not doing mathematics or writing books. They evidently had no capability of recognizing symbols or communicating. No evidence that they were worshiping. What you'll see in the scientific literature, however, they'll say, well, we found this skeleton of a Neanderthal that appears to have been buried, and 20 feet away we see pollen from flowers. That means they must have had a burial ceremony. Well, basically, you're stretching the point a bit. Maybe it's simply an accident that we find the pollen there. And incidentally, it doesn't mean they were holding a funeral service any different than what we see from other animals. For example, if you got a herd of elephants and the matriarch elephant dies, all the elephants in the herd will do a pace around the dead matriarch and they'll heap straw over the dead matriarch. It's an expression of mourning. And you see that with many bird and mammal species. Matter of fact, in our own family, we had a dog and a cat, and the dog died, and the cat mourned the death of that dog for 40 days. And so mourning is not unique to human beings. It's a property of the emotion that we have, but we shouldn't confuse this evidence that they mourn the passing of a member of the community as some kind of spiritual expression. And the case of the Neanderthals already mentioned, no technological advance. What about Homo erectus? They lived from 200,000 to 1.8 million years ago. That's far enough back in time that we can't recover any uncorrupted DNA. We can see that they have a distinct morphology. Their bodies are basically designed for a warmer climate. They're about 5 feet tall and slim. Neanderthal, by comparison, is about as tall as we are, but their bodies are barrel-shaped, and they got short limbs. And they have an enormous nasal capacity. They're basically designed to live in a cold climate. In fact, they have the biggest nasal capacity relative to their body size of any mammal that's ever existed. And the whole point is they could breathe in cold air, and that air would warm sufficiently before it went in to their lungs. And so 30 years ago, 40 years ago, the textbooks were saying Neanderthals were anatomically identical to us human beings. We now know that's incorrect, that they're anatomically quite distinct. Their brain structure is distinct, and basically their bodies are designed barrel-shaped, short limbs. They're designed to hold in body heat. Homo erectus, on the other hand, was more like us, slim body size, shorter than us, not as heavy as us. And but what we notice is, over this 1.6 million year period, we can't see any change in the morphology of the skeletal remains. In other words, the earliest bones we have are no different than the latest bones we have. So if we're the product of natural evolution, why are we not able to see any evolution in the Homo erectus species? And again, they have no symbolic capability. They're not a worshiper, no technological advance. And something that we've been able to do with the Neanderthals and what are referred to as the Denisovans. How many of you ever heard of the Denisovans? Okay, a few of you. These are referring to skeletal remains that they found in Western Siberia. And there's a debate going on over whether or not the Denisovans are simply a side branch of the Neanderthals or distinct species. We have been able to recover DNA from the Denisovans, the Neanderthals, and of course chimpanzees that are alive with us today. And one way we can argue against an evolutionary origin for these different species is looking at the nucleotide differences relative to present-day humans. So if you look at the nucleotide differences amongst the average of all human beings, we see 30 differences, but with Neanderthals, 202 differences, and that difference is enough to tell us they have to be a distinct species. Denisovans, 385, chimpanzees, 1,462. The fact that we only see 30, the average amongst humans, tells us we're relatively recent. This is one of the arguments that we have been created sometime in the last 100 to 120,000 years, is the fact that there's such a short period of time, there's not been much opportunity for nucleotide differences. But this raises a question. Why did God create all these bipedal primate species? And actually, we got this at a conference where one of the leading non-theistic physical anthropologists, Ian Tattersall, he was at a meeting with my colleague, Fazal Rana, and it was basically a debate between Fuzz and a bunch of Christian theistic evolutionists. And it was Ian Tattersall who approached Fuzz and says, you know, what I'm seeing with the bipedal primates, I think beautifully fits your model. It doesn't fit their model. It doesn't really fit my model, but I think it fits your model. And his point was this, is that we've had this sequence of bipedal primates over the past 6 million years, and very roughly each successive species is a little bit better at hunting large-bodied bird and mammal species than the previous one. Now, if you look at chimpanzees, they'll actually use pieces of wood that they get off of trees and use them as spears to hunt down mammals that are a little bit smaller than they are. So they're engaging in this too. But he says, you notice the bipedal primates are more capable at hunting than the chimpanzees. And so what he was suggesting is that maybe this is a way that birds and mammals could be trained to avoid any creature that is tall, bipedal, with weapons in its hands. Because it says the real risk is we human beings are so sophisticated as a predator, we can kill off anything we want. And unlike predators that share the planet with us, we have the capability of hunting the best in the tribe or the herd rather than those that are weak, sick, and dying. We're the only predator on the planet that can kill anything we want. And so what he was pointing out is, notice these bipedal primates do not exist in all the continents of the world. Africa has the full complement, and then Asia next, and then Europe, but North and South America and Australia, we have no evidence of bipedal primates. Although there's one paper claiming maybe we got some evidence in North America, but it is disputed. But this is what Ian Tattersall was sharing with us. When humans came into Australia, they quickly drove to extinction 94% of all the large-bodied bird and mammal species that existed there. And consequently, they were not able to get out of the Stone Age or develop a large population. It wasn't until Europeans brought them the animals that they had killed off that they were able to get out of the Stone Age. And to a lesser degree, the same thing happened in South America and North America. When humans went into South America and North America, they drove to extinction 79% of all the large-bodied bird and mammal species there. That's South America, 73% for North America. And consequently, the humans living in North and South America were not able to get out of the Stone Age because they killed off the horses that were here, the camels that were here, the cows that could be easily domesticated were killed off. And so the creatures that you see mentioned in the book of Job, chapter 38 and 39, that God had created to form relationships with us and to assist us in launching agricultural industry, basically humans in Australia, North and South America had killed them off and therefore couldn't launch the civilization that was easily launched. Now, if you look at sub-Sahara Africa, where we have now documented nearly a dozen different distinct species of bipedal primates, evidently they continuously existed from 6 million years ago through to 100,000 years ago. Notice the extinction rate of large-bodied bird and mammal species is only 4.5%. And so this is evidence that indeed exposing birds and mammals to a sequence over a few million years of bipedal primates, basically trained and equipped them that when you see creatures on two legs with weapons in their hands and they're in a pack, head for the hills, don't go towards them. Now keep in mind that God designed birds and mammals to come to us and to form relationships with us. They want to bond with us. However, God in advance knew that we would sin, and our sin that we would abuse the very creatures that God had given us to bless us. And so God, knowing ahead of time that we humans would sin, created this sequence of bipedal primates basically to ensure that we wouldn't kill off all the animals that we would need for civilization. But it's interesting that we got this from a non-theistic physical anthropologist. Now, in terms of what the Bible says about the origin of human beings, it says that Adam and Eve were the final creation miracle. That's the last miracle of creation that God performed, the only spiritual beings created on earth, and the progenitor of all humans. Now, as to when God created us humans, it doesn't give us a date, but it does tell us that we were created in a garden where four rivers come together. And the four rivers are named the Tigris, the Euphrates, which we know flow through the land of Iraq, and the Gihon and the Pishon. But if you read Genesis 2, it tells you the region of the Gihon and the Pishon, how the Pishon flows out of the mountains of Havilah, where there is gold, and that would be the central mountains of Saudi Arabia, and how the Gihon flows out of the region that it goes down towards the mountains of, the mountains of Ethiopia. And that is a time when there's a land bridge between Arabia and Africa. And so we can actually see those four rivers today. The Gihon and the Pishon are visible on satellite photos as dry riverbeds. But during the last ice age, they would have been flowing rivers. And these four rivers come together in a location that's now 220 feet below sea level. It's in the southeastern portion of the Persian Gulf. But during the last ice age, that region would have been dry ground. During the last ice age, the sea levels were about 400 feet lower than they are today. So that would have been dry ground. That gives us a crude biblical date for when God created Adam and Eve, namely 15,000 to 125,000 years ago. That would be the date when those four rivers would have been above sea level, where they come together. And to give you a little map of this area, this is what Arabia looks like today. But 40,000 to 120,000 years ago, it looked like this. With the sea levels down, the Persian Gulf area was mostly dry ground, likewise the Red Sea. Here's where I think the Garden of Eden is, and the land of Nod. Please don't go there right now, okay? And with the flood, this whole region gets flooded out, and then it restores back to where it is today. But this gives us a rough date for when God created Adam and Eve. Now, another way we can get a date is by calibrating the genealogy that we see in Genesis chapter 11. And we can do that calibration because we have an accurate date for when Abraham lived. Historical records tell us he lived about 4,000 years ago. The biblical genealogies put it the same date. And then another individual we got is Peleg. It tells us in Genesis 10, the world was divided in the days of Peleg. And this is a time when God was scattering humanity over the face of the earth. And that's a reference to the breaking of the Bering land bridge. And we got an accurate date for when the Bering Strait formed. And that's 11,500 years ago. You can take those two dates and you can calibrate the genealogy and you get a rough date of 70,000 years ago, plus or minus 50,000 years. Now, we're not getting accurate dates here, but we are getting rough dates. And then we can use carbon-14 dating to establish what are called the cultural Big Bangs, where it recognizes evidence for modern human technological activity. And so art and music, advanced art and music, dates back to 33,000 years ago. The making of bakery products, 36,000 years ago. Jewelry, clothing, language, complex tools, these are all unique to human beings. Incidentally, we humans displaced the Neanderthals because we wore clothes and they didn't. And so even though they were designed in terms of their body to be able to withstand a climate zone 15 degrees colder than we can withstand without clothes, because of clothing, we were able to actually do better in a cold climate than they could. But notice that these dates all tell us that humans have been around for at least 40,000 years. So basically, God created Adam and Eve somewhere between 40,000 years ago and 125,000 years ago. Now, we look at chromosome 21. That's one of our human chromosomes. We notice that only three haplotypes. Now, that's a genetic technical term that means a set of mutated nucleotides. But you only have three haplotypes in chromosome 21, describing 80% of the entire human population. Now, we can measure the rate of mutational change that's going on in our DNA, and the fact that we have so few in chromosome 21 tells us that we have a relatively recent origin, likely something in the last 100,000 years. So looking at the genetic data, we get a date that's consistent with the human, or with the biblical date. Now, I want to raise with you, we've been engaged with BioLogos, which is a leading Christian organization promoting the view that God used natural evolution to bring about us human beings. They take the position that we humans are the result of common natural descent from the chimpanzees and the Neanderthals. We take the position that we're specially created by God in the Garden of Eden somewhere in the last 120,000 years, that we're not the product of naturalistic evolution, but a special creation. But part of the debate we've been having with them over the past 11 years is, I say, look at chromosome 2, okay? And their whole point is we have 23 pairs of chromosomes compared to the 24 of the chimpanzees. And our theistic evolution friends have been arguing that what happened is that two of the chromosomes that we had with a common ancestor with a chimpanzee joined together, and that explains why we have 23 pairs and not 24 pairs. And if you look at chromosome 2, they say we have what looks like extra sets of centromeres and telomeres. Now, telomeres are like the aglets on your shoelaces. They basically stop the end and the beginning of the shoelace. Our chromosomes are the same way. They got a little cap at the end and at the beginning that ensure that the chromosome's length remains intact. And then that little blue strip there represents what are called the centromere, the center part. But actually, if you look at the scientific literature on this, the telomeres that we see at both ends are real telomeres. The one we see in the middle, the scientific literature says they're telomere-like. They're not exactly like telomeres, but they look like telomeres. So there's some debate about whether or not they're really telomeres. And likewise, in terms of the centromeres, centromere-like. And so again, this is being debated. But the point that we've been making in our debates with our theistic evolutionary and evolutionary biology friends is that when we actually do see fusion events happening in real time. I mean, for example, Down syndrome is an example where you wind up with an extra chromosome. And so there are places where you get an extra chromosome or a chromosome disappears. But in 100% of the cases where we see this going on naturalistically, it is catastrophic to the individual. Either results in the immediate death of the individual or some severe physical handicaps for the individual. We have yet to see a successful fusion event or a successful separation event. Now, our whole point is, it's quite possible that the Creator may have done some kind of fusion event, but it's something that He would have to control in such a way as to ensure that it wouldn't have catastrophic consequences. Even so, we're not convinced by the literature that this is a true fusion event. Now, the other debate that we've been having with them is over vitamin C. And most mammals make their own vitamin C. The exceptions are the great apes, we human beings, a few bats, fruit-eating bats, and guinea pigs. They don't make their own vitamin C. And the argument is that, well, what happened was that there was a mutational event that caused us to lose the capacity to manufacture vitamin C. And this is viewed as a defect. And so the fact that we share this defect with the chimpanzees tells us that we're the product of a common descent. Now, the rebuttal that we've developed at Reasons to Believe is to make the point, we dispute that this is actually a defect. We think it's a benefit in the sense that we humans have a large brain that we want to keep functional for 80 or 90 years. And the creatures that make their own vitamin C basically make enormous amounts of this vitamin C, and it floods all of our organs with this vitamin C. And just in case if you're taking vitamin C supplements, don't overdo it. I mean, taking 1,000 milligrams a day is okay, but not 20,000. You say, where did you come up with that number? Well, that's basically how much the creatures that manufacture their own vitamin C make. And this floods through all their organs, but since they're only living 10 to 15 years, it doesn't make that much difference. But for those, especially those of us with large brains and we want to keep functioning, if you flood the brain with huge amounts of vitamin C over a long period of time, it damages the function of the brain. And what we see in humans and chimpanzees is that they get their vitamin C from their diet, but the human body is designed to recycle the vitamin C. So creatures that don't make their own vitamin C, there's no recycling mechanism, which is why they have to manufacture a lot of vitamin C, because it gets flushed out of the body, it doesn't get recycled. But we notice with chimpanzees and humans and guinea pigs as well, is they got this amazing recycling system. And it's such that we can take in vitamin C from our diet at a small enough amount that it doesn't damage our organs, and it's efficiently recycled so that you maintain that level of vitamin C throughout your entire life. And we're actually arguing this is a far more sophisticated and beneficial design than if we were making our own vitamin C. But that's part of the debate we've been having. Another part of the debate we've been having is the fact that they'll say, well, the genetics models are consistent with us being descended from 10,000 individuals. If you read Francis Collins' best-selling book, he makes the point that as a geneticist, the models appear to indicate that we're not descended from two individuals, we're descended from more than 10,000. But I remember a debate I had with the president of BioLogos a few years ago, and I said, you know, I'm a lot older than you are, Deb. I can remember when they were saying that we were descended from a million individuals. And then it dropped to 100,000. That happened about 30 years ago. And then we had Francis Collins come out with his book about a decade ago where he said 10,000. And when Fuzz Rana debated the geneticist Dennis Venema a few years ago, he was saying 1,200. Then I heard the figure 800. And Deb said I could go as low as 132. And I said, well, how about if we plot a graph and see which way it's going? Look down to the biblical two. But the other point that we were making is this is a model that assumes an evolutionary perspective to start with. Basically, it's assuming that we're the result of common descent through mutations, natural selection. And I said, you're beginning with an assumption and proving your assumption through your model. Your model is, your theoretical model is dependent on an evolutionary perspective. And I said, if that model was actually producing reliable results, and I said, it might well be, could be that you are coming from a correct perspective, it will be consistent with field experiments that have been done. And the point is, it's not consistent with the field experiments. So for example, what was done a number of years ago, they went to this place called the Kerguelen Islands. And here's a blow up of the Kerguelen Islands. It's the most isolated place you can go in the world. In fact, I wrote a paper on this when I was a grad student saying this would be a perfect place to go to do radio astronomy because there is no any interference from human activity there. It's just so isolated. But what they did is they picked that little island with the indicated by the red arrow, and they put two sheep on that island. This is what it looks like, kind of a barren place. And this is the sheep that they put there. And they put these two sheep, a male and a female, where they had measured their DNA. And what they noticed is they were quite ingrown. The DNA of both the male and the female was quite similar. And there were no other mammals on this island. And they let them reproduce. And they came back 12, 15 generations later, measured their DNA, and what they discovered is the DNA was far more differentiated than what the models predicted. Now, that's important because when Francis Collins and Dennis Venomous say we're descended from a much larger population than two, they get that by looking at human beings today, measuring their genetic differences, and using that to work back to what was the ancestral population of human beings. When we do the same experiment on sheep, what we discover is we get way more genetic diversity than what the models predict. And it's not just with the sheep. We see this also with Przewalski horses, that we get more DNA than what the models predict. And also we see this with orangutans. In fact, it's now been done in four different species of mammals. What we see, for example, is that we got 7,000 Sumatran orangutans, 45,000 orangutans in Borneo. You would predict that the Borneo orangutans would have greater genetic diversity, but we see the opposite. So again, that calls the theoretical models into question. And William Arnos, a geneticist and an anthropologist, he wrote about this in Nature News, commenting on this and says, well, we don't fully understand the relationship between genetic diversity and population size. In other words, he's making the point, simply measuring the genetic diversity of species that exist today is useless for determining the ancestral population. But this is a key part of the debate that we're having with our friends at Biologos and with other theistic evolutionists. Now, when you look at the mitochondrial DNA, it is consistent with us being descended from one female or a small number of females. And so I do agree with my theistic evolution friends. It could be consistent with a small population more than two, but it's also consistent with all of us being descended from a single woman. And you get a rough date that the first woman lived 150,000 years ago, give or take 150,000 years. The genetic dates are not as accurate as the biblical dates. But if you assume heteroplasmy, you get a date of about 50,000 years ago, plus or minus 50,000. You say, what is heteroplasmy? Well, 10% of us get two sets of mitochondrial DNA. 1% of us get three sets. And when you take into account that a few of us have two or three sets, it actually reduces the date by about a factor of three. But here's the other key point. When we look at ancient human mitochondrial DNA and compare it with modern human mitochondrial DNA, we can't measure any evolution. So it shows that we're not seeing any significant evolution. Y chromosome measures evolution on the male side, and it is consistent with us being descended from one man or a few men. And here they get a date of 180,000 years ago, plus or minus 180,000 years. And again, we don't see significant evolution in the DNA. Bottom line, we are fearfully and wonderfully made by a creator, not by some naturalistic evolutionary process. And again, we're giving away a free chapter of Who is Adam at reasons.org/Ross. With that, I'll take the remainder of time for questions. And we're going to alternate between questions from the group here and questions from the live streaming audience. Got a question here? Yeah, please wait for the microphone.
said it could be one or a small group for the male and the female. How does the Genesis flood affect that?
Well, the Genesis flood, you mean these dates. Okay, the first edition of Who is Adam, the scientific literature is claiming dates for the Y chromosome that at error bars as small as 4,000 years. And the error bars as small as 4,000 years, we could actually test whether or not you get a younger date for the first man through Y chromosome than you do for the first woman through mitochondrial DNA. And the whole point is that the flood account tells us that we're really all descended from the one man, Noah. And so on that biblical basis, you would anticipate a younger date or a more recent date for the Y chromosome first male than you would for the first woman. The problem is the error bars are now recognized to be so large, we can't tell the difference. When it's plus or minus 180,000 years, you're not going to be able to tell the difference between the date for Adam and the date for Noah. But yeah, when we were thinking the error bars were small, that was a possibility. But no longer is that the case. I mean, the main revision we made in Who is Adam is that the dates are nowhere near as accurate as what people were claiming 10 years ago. And incidentally, we're arguing that the dates will probably never get any more accurate from the genetic side than we have right now. There's fundamental reasons why we can't get more accurate dates. Got a question here? Right here.
Am I supposed to stand up? Is that not
no, that's fine. You don't have to stand up.
You mentioned early on about the development of consciousness from inanimate material to living material. Then you also talked about emotion. And that caught my interest because, is there a relation between consciousness and emotion? Does every animal experience emotion? That's like a fish. You know, they are hurt. So I guess that's an area that I'm confused about. I mean, it seems like the question of consciousness and emotion seems to be another aspect of life. But anyway, what's the relationship there?
Okay, good point. And it's hard to define consciousness. So what you see in the scientific literature, they talk about human consciousness and animal consciousness. Because, you know, clearly our pets are capable of forming relationships with one another and forming relationships with us. They can actually respond to our commands. They're thinking animals. They're volitional animals. They can say, I don't want to do that. I mean, my cat often tells me what she doesn't want to do. So there's a volition being expressed there. But it's limited in the sense that they don't use the consciousness that they have to engage in mathematics or philosophy or theology. I mean, my cat and my dog, they really don't ask questions like, gee, why am I here? They want to know where their food is, but as far as why am I here or is there a God, what's the purpose of the universe, they don't even care if there is a universe. And so that seems to be unique to us human beings. And that's why I put it in the biblical context. God gave a certain level of consciousness to the birds and mammals so that they could form a relationship and serve and please a higher species. He gave us humans an even higher level of consciousness so that we can discover the existence of God and form a relationship with God and serve and please that God. And so, but again, trying to define this with physics and chemistry is very difficult. I mean, I got 50 books on the origin of consciousness in my office, and these are all written by scientists who are not believers, and they say, you know, it's difficult enough for us to even define consciousness, let alone figure out where it could come from. It's interesting, there are speculations on the origin of consciousness. I mean, most of them try to claim that it's something that evolved and the chemistry and the physics as you went from microbes up to human beings, but they can't really identify exactly where the consciousness comes in or how. I've seen sophisticated attempts by physicists where they say, we think it's something happening at the quantum level, and maybe it's in the microtubules that are going on in the neurons in our brain, but the bottom line is they can't make a connection there either. Of these 50 books I have, they basically all say, we haven't got a clue where this consciousness comes from. But the reason they don't have a clue is they're trying to explain the origin of something that's clearly non-physical from something that is purely physical. So that, I think, is the disconnect. But I think that explains why theists can come up with a good explanation for the origin of consciousness, but the non-theists are stuck in the sense that they're trying to explain it from physics and chemistry, and when they do, they're basically discovering, we don't have the foggiest idea how this works or how it comes about. But it's not for lack of trying. They've been trying for 50, 60 years using the most sophisticated science they've got, and still they're coming up with nothing. My colleague, our staff philosopher, Ken Samples, argues this is one of the strongest pieces of evidence for a Christian worldview of the origin of consciousness. But bottom line is, it's even hard for those with a theistic worldview to actually define what it is and how our consciousness is different, say, from the consciousness of the animals. But clearly, when you're looking at bacteria, we don't see anything akin to consciousness there, although you made a good point. All life seems to respond to dangerous stimuli. And so frogs, for example, experience pain, but they don't have an emotional bond with one another or with other creatures. But yeah, they do respond to pain. So that's something to keep in mind when you go fishing. That little fish that you catch actually does feel the pain of the hook.
Hugh, I got the mic. The mic over here. He's got to wait his turn. A quick question. Speaking of the last 60 years, science for the last 60 years have been trying to find the missing link between humans and these bipedal primates. And various candidates I know in the past have been said, oh, we found it. And then once they look at it more closely, they say, well, maybe that's not it. Could you tell us what the current status of the scientific community is? There is no missing link. Is that the correct interpretation? I mean, Anthro was that went away, somebody else came in, and that's gone. Am I correct? Or what is the status of the current view of the missing link?
Yeah, the current view of the missing link is they're avoiding that term.
Because they told me the more they dig, they would find it. The more we dig, we haven't found it.
Well, what the problem is what I mentioned earlier, is that rather than these new discoveries giving support to the idea that we evolved a kind of along a tree of life pathway, that's not what the data is showing us. We're not seeing a progression of greater and greater cranial capacity with greater and greater frontal lobe capacity. We're seeing that it just basically goes up and down and jumps. Likewise, our bipedal capability. I mean, what really threw it in the chaos was the discovery of Homo florensis. That's the most recent of the bipedal primate finds that have been discovered. Homo florensis stands about 3 feet high and has a brain capacity that's equivalent to that of a chimpanzee, 4 times smaller than the human brain capacity. So that really threw things into chaos. It's like, this is the most recent find, but it's got a very small brain capacity, and it's only 3 feet tall, and its bipedal capability is more primitive than that of the Neanderthals. And that's just one of many examples. And so, yes, how they respond is basically stop using the term.
For that matter, all species are missing links in that case, right? I mean, not just humans.
Well, what I haven't mentioned is that I did make a reference to some field experiments. They've been doing field experiments where they study mammals over a period of decades. And what they're discovering is, if you're looking at a mammal, now they haven't done this with sea mammals, but with terrestrial mammals, that the body, adult body size is bigger than 3 kilograms, that is bigger than 7 pounds, the species goes extinct before it experiences any significant evolutionary change. And the problem here is all the bipedal primates have an adult body size bigger than 7 pounds. And as already mentioned, they all have small population sizes. The smaller the population size, the lower the probability of evolutionary change. Incidentally, in my book, More Than a Theory, I made the point that where you get a probability, a decent probability for evolutionary change, is where you got a species population size that exceeds 1 quadrillion. So ants and termites and microbes are in that category. And notice for those species, we're actually able to measure evolutionary change with respect to time. That's because they've got an enormous population. Moreover, you need a short generation time. And so with microbes, the generation time is 20 minutes. They're born, and 20 minutes later, they reproduce. And the shorter the generation time, the higher the probability of getting evolutionary change. The problem with the bipedal primates is we're looking at generation times of years. We're talking like maybe 8 years for the Neanderthals. And incidentally, that's one of the things I didn't discuss, that is discussed in Who is Adam, is we have a very long generation time. 25 years for men, 24 years for women. You women may have realized that men don't develop quite as rapidly as women do. We're a little bit delayed. So, in fact, I got to experience that personally when I was doing a film shoot on top of Mauna Kea, because the guys I had behind the camera were all men who were 18, 19, 20 years of age. And they were passing out on me because their lungs weren't fully developed. It takes literally that full 25 years for the lungs to fully mature. So I was doing fine, but they were all passing out on me. So, but the whole point is, given that we're talking 24, 25 years, that's radically different from what we see from any of the bipedal primates. They're all 8 years and less. But even at 8 years and less, we realize that eliminates the possibility that they could change in any significant evolutionary way. So, I mean, every manner. I mean, they got a small population, they got a long generation time, a small habitat space, complex biochemistry. Those are all factors that go against a decent possibility of evolutionary change. Okay, who's next?
Yeah, we
got
questions.
Oh, okay, you got the mic.
Yeah,
all right.
I got it. Okay. When you were asking about the way that you can describe the consciousness of a human being compared to all other animals, I think one of them is that the dog, I have a dog and a cat and always have, but I don't think that each one of them thinks of itself, knows of it, that it is an individual. It's just a location where things happen. It sees and it thinks and it, but do you think that they react, that they know that they are an individual?
Well, they know where they stand in the pecking order. So, I mean, if you get a pack of dogs, I mean, they rank themselves from the top down to the bottom. Same thing with wild horses. So they seem to know where their position is within the herd or the group. So in that sense, they do have some sense of individuality. The big difference with human beings, though, is their symbolic capability. For example, you can put a computer tablet in front of a six-month-old child, and they can figure out how to make it work. That doesn't work with a dog or a bird or a chimpanzee. It becomes something to play with, but they really don't engage with it. The other thing that's unique to us human beings is the fact that we can respond to letters and numbers and symbolic signs. I mean, for example, you can't train a non-human animal to figure out what a railway crossing sign is all about, or what a stop sign is. So even very simple symbols, they're not capable of. But the amazing thing is that humans, even at a very young age, can figure out the meaning of letters and numbers, and actually use those letters and numbers for complex language communication, and for mathematics, and use that to actually conceive of philosophical thought patterns. That's unique to us human beings. We don't see that in the Neanderthals or any other creature. There is some speculation that Neanderthals had control of fire, but all we see in the scientific literature is that their control of fire was no better than we see with the chimpanzees. Chimpanzees, for example, when they see a wildfire, they'll run towards the wildfire and throw a bunch of nuts into the wildfire, because they know that that's going to roast the nuts and going to be a little bit easier to crack open. They'll come back when the fire is over and recover it. But it's not like that they're taking two pieces of wood and getting sparks and starting a fire and controlling the fire. And we see no evidence of any of the non-human primates being able to actually control fire. Or do they have the capability of taking advantage of wildfire? Apparently, yes, they do. Okay. Who's got the mic? Oh, you got the mic. Okay.
You talked about God giving us the hardware to experience God, left inferior parietal. When Mike Persinger stimulated this with...
You need to put the microphone a little closer to your mouth. Thank you.
When Mike Persinger simulated this hardware with old-school transcranial mag stim, it caused people to reproduce that feeling of being close to God. But then when Dawkins got Persinger to stimulate that, he just twitched. Why do you think God didn't give Dawkins that ability? All I can think of is, you know, Dawkins really makes us better Christians with his... with his scathing criticism, but he really makes us better.
Well, it's interesting when I engage atheist scientists is how compelled they are to think about the non-existence of God. I mean, my dog and cat, they don't consider God's existence or non-existence. But it's like we human beings, we're in one camp or the other. We're either passionate about God's existence or passionate about God's non-existence. I'll give you an example. Back in 2008, I was invited to do a debate at the International Skeptic Society conference held at Caltech. And it was an all-weekend conference. All day Saturday, they had five of the world's leading atheist physicists give talks on the non-existence of God. And one of the things I noticed, the whole focus was on the God of the Bible. The other gods of the religions of the world got a free skate. The whole focus was on the God of the Bible. And I also noticed how passionate they were about the non-existence of this God. And so after the debate I had with Victor Stenger, it was the last part of the program, I stayed around for several hours and engaged the atheist in the audience and said, you know, I think I just come up with a new argument for my Christian worldview as being at your conference this weekend. Because what I've noticed is there was 800 of you here, and your passion about the non-existence of God was palpable. I mean, the emotion in this room was incredible about the non-existence of this God. And all the lectures were focused on the God of the Bible. It says, if you were really convinced that God doesn't exist, you'd be treating him like the tooth fairy or the great pumpkin. But instead, your passion tells me you really do believe in God, but you don't like him. And I think that describes Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins admits that he had a very abusive experience with a priest when he was 13 years of age. And so I think what you're seeing in Richard Dawkins is an individual who really does believe in God, but doesn't like that God. And so because if he was convinced that God didn't exist, he would be ignoring him, just like he ignores the tooth fairy and the great pumpkin. But his passion tells me, he's really got an agenda here. And what was interesting, too, is when I shared that with these atheists in the audience at that conference, they said, Dr. Ross, it's not that we hate the God of the Bible. Rather, it's that we despise his followers. And so then they all began to tell me stories of their bad experiences with Christians that they had met. And that is so true of atheists. In fact, when I was talking to Victor Stenger, he told me, you know, I've been an atheist all my life, but I was an altar boy in the Roman Catholic Church. when I was growing up. And I says, well, can you tell me about it? He says, no, I can't tell you about it. Something happened there which made it difficult for him to even speak about it. And I can tell you this, 90% of the atheist scientists I've debated have had bad experiences with the Christian community. Now, one response, I think, see what they're doing as being irrational. Why are they letting what the Bible tells us are clearly fallen, sinful, evil human beings get between them and a God who is perfectly moral and loving and kind without sin or evil? It's completely irrational. But the Bible tells us when we reject the existence of God, we do become irrational in our thinking. Romans chapter 1. Right here. We'll get the microphone to you eventually. Yeah, but keep it close to your mouth.
Okay. Hello.
There we go.
With the illustration of the sheep and us coming from just two people, for the most part, that I have to confront the fact that brothers and sisters then had to, you know, get together. Is that true? And how does that work with the, how is that possible? Because we look down on that now, and that doesn't work today.
Yeah, good question. And I get that from my non-theistic scientist friends all the time. From a biblical perspective, if you've got Adam and Eve being the ones that give rise to the entire human species, that means one of their daughters had to have physical intercourse with one of her brothers. And what you notice in the Bible is there's no prohibition against brother-sister marriages until the book of Exodus. In the book of Genesis, no. You also notice that Abraham was married to his half-sister. So evidently, it was permitted. By the time of Moses, Moses made the comment, we're going to have these laws so we'll no longer have the diseases of the Egyptians. And that was partly in reference to the fact that in Egypt, the pharaohs were considered to be gods. And as gods, they can only marry fellow gods. And so the pharaohs were marrying their sisters. And this had been going on generation after generation after generation. And what happened was the pharaohs were having hemophilia. And that's what happens when you do that close interbreeding. However, one thing we know about animals, you know how they get all these different breeds of dogs? They will basically take a sister and a brother and have them mate in order to propagate a particular characteristic they're doing, wanting to get. And they know they can do that for 20 consecutive generations without running a significant risk of a genetic defect. But after 20 generations, the risk becomes high. So that would explain why no problem in Genesis, big problem in Exodus. So for the first few generations of humanity, it wouldn't be an issue. Later on, it would. Now that's assuming, however, that God created Adam and Eve with relatively distinct DNA. And so, for example, these sheep that they put on that island in the Kerguelen Archipelago, their DNA was actually quite similar, quite ingrown. But even so, they got way more genetic diversity than what the theistic evolutionary genetic models predict. And that was the whole point. We humans have more genetic diversity than we would expect if we were descended from just two individuals. But field experiments tell us you'll get that even if we are descended from just two individuals. But yeah, I think Cain had to marry either a niece or a sister or someone. And incidentally, people say, well, how did he populate a city? Well, by the time he's 60 or 90 years of age, you already got many hundreds of people on the face of the earth. You'll see a chart in Navigating Genesis where I actually show you how rapidly the human population grows. If indeed you got people that are reproductive for 600 years of their lifespan and are doing everything they can to prevent birth, even if you do everything you can to prevent birth with the technology they have back then, that's a minimum of 150 children for every woman. Think about that, ladies, 150 children. But you get a rather rapid growth of population. Matter of fact, the table shows you that if people are not murdering one another, you get 17 billion humans on the face of the earth by the time Adam is 760 years old. So when God told Adam to multiply and fill the earth, he could have done it in his own lifespan. But it also tells us the reason that didn't happen, murder went completely out of control. Okay, this couple down here has been waiting. Oh, you got a microphone finally.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Yeah, the Nephilim. The Nephilim?
Nephilim, yeah.
About, yeah. Where did they come from? How were they created differently from us humans?
Okay, the question of the Nephilim. Now, I devote a whole chapter to that and an appendix in Navigating Genesis. And we are giving away a free chapter of that, too, at reasons.org/Ross. It tells us in Genesis 6 that the sons of God had intercourse with the daughters of men and gave rise to the Nephilim. So the Nephilim are the result of this interbreeding. I call it interbreeding because if you do a word study on sons of God or children of God throughout the entire Bible, you recognize that term cannot be applied to human beings until after the day of Pentecost. So in the Bible, we humans are not referred to as sons of God or children of God until we receive the baptism in the Holy Spirit, which means that the sons of God in Genesis 6 would have to be referring to angelic beings, because God created two distinct species of intelligent life, human beings and angels. Now, there are different theories on who these sons of God were. Were they angels having intercourse with human women, or were they demon-possessed humans having intercourse with women? But the whole point is something angelic was going on, and evidence for that is what you see in Jude 6, where God refers to certain fallen angels or demons as having left their estate. And because they left their estate, they're consigned to the abyss. And evidently, God created a special prison house for these fallen angels who left their estate. That's how it's translated in English. The Greek original is basically something that would be consistent with bestiality. In other words, they're having intercourse with individuals that were not part of their species. And it also explains why we don't see the phenomena going on today. Now, critics have said the Bible says the angels don't marry. It says they don't marry, but doesn't say they can't marry. And so they may have had direct intercourse, or it might have been through demon-possessed men. Again, evidence that something supernatural is going on there is the supernatural qualities of the Nephilim. You know, there are two that are named in the Bible. Well, you've got Goliath and his four brothers. And then you also have the king of Bashan. And it tells us that he had a bed minimum of 13 feet long, 6 feet wide, made out of iron. So evidently, he was big enough he needed a bed that long. And it tells us that Goliath had a minimum height of 9 feet, 9 inches. And that he went into battle carrying a minimum of 250 pounds of armor and weapons. And what you'll see in Navigating Genesis, I got a chapter there called The Physics of Basketball, basically making the point that basketball is a sport that gives you a very high premium for your height. I mean, your ability to sink a basket goes up with a square of your height, which means a 7-footer, given equal skills, will get twice as many baskets as a 5-footer. So if you want to know why the NBA recruits 7-footers and not 5-footers, that's one reason why. And they know they're going to get more baskets. But the other thing we notice is the best players in the NBA are not the ones that are in excess of 7 feet tall. Basically, the best are about 6 feet, 6 inches, or 6 feet, 7 inches. Because as you get past that, you get a drop in mobility. And probably the best example of that, go back 10 years ago when the Lakers had Kobe Bryant and Shaquille O'Neal, and you notice they didn't get along well with one another. The reason they didn't get along well with one another, Kobe got frustrated at how long he had to wait for Shaquille O'Neal to lumber down the court where he could pass him the basketball. So I might as well dunk it myself rather than wait for Shaquille to get down here. And the point was, he had such a tall body and a heavy body, it limited his mobility. And incidentally, we see that there's a growth hormone disability with certain humans where they just keep growing. None of them make it to 9 feet tall. They all die before they hit 9 feet. And once they get to be about 8 feet, they basically become wheelchair bound. In fact, do you ever remember that movie, 007, where they had this guy playing Jaws? He was 7'7". By the way, he was a Christian. And I got to meet him, but he was wheelchair bound by the time I met him. And basically what happens when you're that height is the mobility loss catches up with you as you age. You're not going to live long. But the very fact that Goliath could go into battle at 9 feet nine with 250 pounds of armor and be a great warrior and a champion on the battlefield means there was something supernatural about him. The other thing you notice is the Nephilim in the Bible are described as being male. There's not a single reference to a female Nephilim. And they're all described as having six toes and six fingers. They got birth defects. So this, again, would be evidence that there was some kind of bestiality going on there. So sorry to give you a long answer. But I've been running into a lot of Bible prophecy teachers who claim that we're being invaded by the Nephilim today. And I don't see any evidence of humans running around that tall or that capable or that evil. And so when were the Nephilim wiped out? From what I can tell is that it was the 30 mighty men of King David that wiped out the last of the Nephilim. So for the past 3,000 years, there have been no Nephilim. And I think the reason why is what you see in Jude 6. The demons know that if they ever dare to do that with women ever again, they're getting a one-way ticket to the abyss. So, and they don't like the abyss. There's lots of evidence that it's a very unpleasant place. In fact, when Jesus cast out demons, what did the demons say? Don't send us to the abyss. He didn't send any of them to the abyss because none of them had committed that degree of evil. Looks like we're out of time. Okay, thank you.